From WXXI News, this is Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We are talking infrastructure this hour, and didn't take long when Matthew Leonard and I asked for a little help from our followers on Twitter to look for examples of dilapidated bridges, some sagging infrastructure. There are plenty of examples out there in the Rochester area, Western New York, certainly across New York State. The state's roads and bridges are, as Matthew's been saying, in a bit of a mess, and there are questions about how to replace them, how to repair them, who pays for it, and how does that all come about? We're going to try to address all of those questions and more this hour. And Matthew Leonard, I've been saying all day here, this is not the sexiest topic, but it's one of the most important to all of us who drive on New York State infrastructure, which is most of us.
Absolutely, and to economic development and a whole range of other things.
No question.
So here's a number for you, $45.2 billion. That's one estimate of the amount states would need to spend to bring road up to good repair. In our part of the United States, a bit under 40%, 39%, according to one of our the organizations one of our guests comes from, are either structurally deficient or obsolete. So that's a pretty big number, and we tend to overlook infrastructure because it's not the most glamorous thing. It also tends to be something that's sort of ignored often by policymakers because of there's very little sort of short-term political benefit from investing in projects that may not come to fruition under your
They love the glitz of a $100 million art center or, big boats and whatnot. But yes, infrastructure is important. And this hour, I'd like to, by the way, as the super ignorant person on a very intelligent panel, when we talk about structurally deficient or obsolete, some of us might immediately conclude that they are in danger of collapse or whatnot. And I'd like to sort of differentiate between what some of the terminology means, what we really know about the status of it. And we've got a great panel to help us with that. The man in studio with Matthew and myself is Sam Anthony. He's a bridge engineer at the consulting firm Erdman Anthony. He's the president-elect for the American Society of Civil Engineers Rochester section. And every time you drive over the Frederick Douglass Susan B. Anthony Bridge in Rochester, you are driving over Sam Anthony's work. Congratulations on that. It is a beautiful bridge, and thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, Evan.
And you said during the break you want to make sure people understand Sam Anthony not related to Susan B. Anthony.
That's right. No
Even though the bridge bears your name in a number of ways. We have a couple of guests on the line as well, Matthew.
We're also joined Patrick Sable from the Brookings Metropolitan, Brookings Institution, of course, in Washington, D.C. Patrick, thanks very much for being with us on Innovation Friday.
No, I'm excited to be a part of this, and certainly I can help bring a national perspective and talk about some of the things that we're seeing across the country that are proactive and not just kind of the gloom and doom we hear out of Washington, D.C. Pretty much every day.
We call that solutions journalism. We're very glad to have you
yeah,
on board.
That's right.
Patrick, you're interested in policy and financial tools particularly, which is always important. And also, but not lastly, Rocky Moretti is the Director of Research for TRIP, which is National Transportation Research Group, but also in Washington, D.C. Rocky, thanks very much for being with us as well.
Yes, certainly. Glad to be on.
So, Rocky, let's start with you because your organization, TRIP, of which you're the director of research, put out a kind of a report card, really, on the condition and safety of New York's roads and bridges. It's pretty current. The date stamp says March 2015, so that's pretty current. Could you just walk us through what the main points of that finding were from your point of view?
Sure. Yeah, just a month ago, we were at several press events across the state putting out the report. And unfortunately, really what the report points out is this tremendous infrastructure deficit that New York State has. And then we point out what that impact is on the public. But obviously, more critically, those impacts are statewide and impact the state's economy. But in terms of the key numbers, more than a third of the state's major locally and state-maintained roads are currently graded as being in poor condition. Those are pavements that have enough deterioration that now the types of repairs that are needed to get them back into a state of good repair, unfortunately, start to become more costly. And that's the challenge. If you can maintain things in relatively good condition, you can do that relatively cheaply, but
right. You're saying actually, you say that it's a factor of 19 is the difference between maintaining something in poor condition and getting it back up to what you declare good condition.
Yeah, a roadway that's essentially in good condition, which means the understructure of the road, the base of it is in good shape, and it's really just keeping the pavements in good condition. You can do simple maintenance work on that pavement for about $85,000 a mile, and will greatly extend its service life. But if you wait until, again, the base is really crumbling, and now you have to take off the top of the road and start to redo the base, that can run up to over $1.5 million per mile. So a dramatic difference. And of course, the problem then becomes local and state governments have these roads in poor condition and are overwhelmed fiscally in terms of trying to address them.
Right. And just for our listeners as well, just to give them the numbers that on that particular topic, 21% of the Rochester roads are poor, 16% mediocre, 24% fair condition, 40% good. So getting up there to the halfway mark. Also, I'm sure all of our listeners would have sympathy for your researchers who are driving over the roads of upstate New York during winter when that becomes a really obvious thing. But we can laugh. But obviously, there's a number of kick-on effects from that, including safety, economic benefit, and so on. So could you sort of give us a sense of why we should care about those kind of abstract figures and what they actually can relate to in terms of human costs and benefit?
Well, I think two numbers really jump out. One is we estimate the average motorist in the Rochester area pays an additional $402 a year maintaining their vehicle on rough roads. Obviously, when roads are in rough condition, it's putting a lot of stress on a vehicle, so you have more routine maintenance, but more critically, the overall components of your vehicle are wearing out that much more quickly, and so you're replacing the vehicle sooner than you would like. So that's a very significant cost. And then I think the other very critical cost, and a very fascinating new study just came out recently from a western state from Oregon, which also is suffering from the future deterioration of roads and bridges. They looked at their current condition, and they recognized with their funding levels, things are going to get a lot worse. They had economists study what happens to a state that allows their infrastructure to deteriorate, in this case, roads and bridges. The estimate came back that over the next 20 years, because of things getting worse in terms of conditions, that they would lose $9.4 billion in economic growth and 100,000 fewer jobs would be created because of the less efficient transportation system. They looked at how much it would cost to avoid that deterioration and concluded that the benefit of spending the money on repairing roads was 12 to 1. Essentially, every dollar invested in keeping your roads and bridges from getting worse would avoid $12 in lost economic growth.
And that's a point that seems to be lost on the people who make these decisions, because we continue to outspend on new roads compared to spending on maintaining the roads we already have. Isn't that right?
Well, New York State, I just was in Michigan a few days ago. I mean, really the norm, particularly in states with older infrastructures, really the investment's just trying to maintain what they have. Mm-hmm. There's not really a whole lot of new capacity being built. But again, that comes at an economic cost, because when large companies, when organizations are going to hire a lot of people, are looking at a region, they may say, well, we need these additional infrastructure components, a new interchange or some ramps built, or there may be some components that they want. And states that have infrastructure in a good state of repair and say, yeah, we'd be willing to go ahead and make those improvements, those are the ones that are going to attract the jobs. And conversely, states with crumbling infrastructure that have no money to add additional capacity, and we're not talking about massive new highways, it's usually some components that help make a system work a bit more efficiently, they're not competing effectively for those jobs because they don't have the money in place for infrastructure.
But to make sure that we understand exactly what you mean by this, again, 12 to 1 is sort of the benefit in terms of dollars. Do it now before things get worse, and make the improvements and allow for not only for better and safer roadways, but better economic development, attracting jobs, et cetera. That's clear to me. What's not clear is that what percentage of the roads, Matthew, you said, take Rochester, for example, 40% good, there's good, fair. What's the breakdown, the sliding scale?
So the talking about the roads, according to Trip, we had 40% good, 24 about a quarter fair. Less than that were kind of mediocre and And poor,
mediocre and poor.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
if you combine those, if you combine those, that's obviously you've got nearly 40% poor or mediocre and 40% good. Roughly.
But are you, gentlemen? Are we replacing or repairing when they are mediocre or when they are poor? At what point do you say now is the time that needs to be done?
I mean, as someone who works a lot with states and localities across the country, it's the squeaky wheel gets the oil. When we look at around the country where things are getting replaced, it's really where a lot of times, the state localities, their hand is forced because of an economic development issue, or really having an opportunity where they can demonstrate that the project has real economic benefits. So we're seeing a lot of times cities and states that are doing a good job replacing infrastructure, especially around transportation, are those that can make a very clear case of exactly what their taxpayers are getting for their investment. So if you look at a place like Oklahoma City, which might not be on everyone's radar as a place that's great for infrastructure, but the mayor there has done an excellent job in terms of showing exactly what each ballot initiative, each bonding initiative gets their residents, showing exactly these are the roads you're getting. It's not abstract. You're getting exactly this connection. You're getting exactly this paving. And we've seen a lot of success in areas that can really tie it to something specific as opposed to just these big numbers, which I think are hard for people to wrap their heads around. You know, what does 40% of roads in poor condition mean? We struggle all the time with, how many billions of dollars? Well, billions of dollars, I think, are hard for a lot of constituents to wrap their heads around, and how would you come up with money like that? So,
right.
Usually I like to tie these to percentages. So if you look across the United States, really to bring our infrastructure up, certainly you're talking about tens, hundreds of billions of dollars, depending on what time frame you use and kind of what baseline you use. But fundamentally, that's a 1% to 2% increase in GDP for the United States in terms of our outlays. So I think it's a lot easier when you start thinking about what the real projects are in terms of how does this affect me on my commute, and how does this actually affect just a reallocation of assets, right? How can we just move some money around or maybe raise some new revenues? That it's not in the billions. How can we think about 1% more investment or 2% more investment, which can really make a difference?
So, Patrick, those kind of policy, those policy discussions, and the communication around those things is as significant sometimes as the kind of the funding that's available. You're saying?
Yeah, and I think the United States we've long kind of shifted this model where we think where the gas tax, all that goes up to Washington, gets redistributed, and that's how we pay for things. And I think there's a really ingrained sense of that's how it works. But fundamentally, if you look at the way that we pay for roads and transportation in the United States, around, it depends the state, but it's between 69 and 73% of that money, depending on the year, comes from states and localities. So
Right. You're
paying for that on the ground with, a penny sales tax. You're paying for that your local gas tax. You're paying with general funds coming in through property taxes.
Right.
Really, the federal government is kind of marginal in all this, even though we hear big numbers about the Highway Trust Fund, which we can talk about as well, which is going bankrupt soon, which a lot of states are going to feel and is going to impact
upstate. And I know this is of interest. Just press pause for a second, Patrick. I just wanted to bring Sam Anthony in here because I know Sam, who's been down in Washington doing some lobbying on this, and we've been talking about money before we came on air. So, Sam, you want to chime in on this?
Yes. We, in upstate New York, New York's a big state, and we have, New York City, the financial capital of the world, but then the rest of the state. But to upstate, 70% of the money we spend on transportation is federal money. So when there's no federal highway bill, there's no work going on up in upstate. It's very important to us. I think, with the Surface Transportation Act that's set to expire on May 31st, as the gentlemen have mentioned, it will be devastating to many, many people. And the recent information is from the Secretary of Transportation that what's probably going to happen is the federal highway bill will be extended a couple of months, and that doesn't really help the states because they can't plan.
Right.
When they can't see the 6-year program out there. It's hard for them to pick the projects to fund to get rehabilitated or replaced. And I would say too, we spend as a practicing engineer. A lot of time deciding what the best option to do is. We're very careful with the taxpayer dollars. There's an algorithm for deciding when to rehab and when to replace. In the bridge world, We follow this algorithm strictly, and you know we're very careful about spending the taxpayer dollars properly.
Right.
Can I just press that for one more point there? Then how do you draw that line? You said you're careful about when to repair, when to replace. How do you know?
Well, let's say we're assigned a bridge, particular bridge project.
Right.
We go out, we inspect it, hands on, touch every element of it, and decide what the real deterioration has done and what the work needs to be done to fix it. And after we do all that, we run structural calculations and make sure the bridge is capable of handling the loads it's supposed to carry. But then after that, and knowing what needs to be fixed at this point, we estimate the cost of it. So we have an estimate for the rehabilitation cost. We then also look at the replacement cost. We have means in New York State. We have a really good database of what certain spans cost, and we'll compare those two. And if, for example, the rehabilitation cost ends up being more than 85% of the replacement cost, then we'll just replace
it. Just replace it.
When it ends up being between 65% and 85%, we'll look at mitigating factors like safety, number of accidents, and things like that, and make a decision each way. If it's below 65%, we'll definitely rehabilitate it.
Okay, and Sam, is it also true that we can overreact to some of the aesthetics that we see? For example, I mentioned that on Twitter, a number of our listeners over the last couple of days have sent in pictures of bridges that to them look frightening. The parts that are crumbling, etc. You can't comment on what you're not seeing, but at the same time, if we see a crumbling facade or different parts, it's not always a structural issue, or how do you view that when you see those kind of things?
Well, like I say, when we're looking at the rehab replace decision, we're out there touching every element of the bridge, and based on our training, we know what to look for. It's true that you could have some spot delaminations and spalls with exposed rebar and not have a serious problem. That's just a quick repair that could fix it. But I would say, just led by my experience, when you see an indication of that, there's probably a deeper problem somewhere else.
All right. So perhaps it is a sign of trouble. We have some comments and questions have come in from listeners. We will get to those throughout the hour because we've got a lot of ground to cover, Matt.
Sure. So just back to you, Patrick Sable from Brookings. Do you want to talk us about the Federal Highway Bill or the absence thereof, and what sort of alternatives there are to that? And I guess I'm sort of steering us towards some of the other ways in which financing might come around, something that I know you're thinking about.
Yeah, so certainly being in Washington and going to Capitol Hill is depressing in terms of where we are in terms of the debate. And other people on the call have really kind of hammered home how this lack of a solid, reliable stream of revenue is really deeply impactful, especially in more rural areas and some of the areas in the Rust Belt, of which I'm from. I'm from Cleveland. I went to school in upstate New York. I have a deep appreciation for the challenges you guys particularly have. But certainly we're looking at probably a short-term reauthorization, really kicking the can down the road for a couple months. And when I look at what's going on here, I mean, the most intriguing possibility to fund the Highway Trust Fund right now is really around repatriating taxes from corporations that are holding money abroad, which is complicated, has interesting implications for moral hazard and all these issues around how we think about global corporations like Google and Apple, Microsoft, how they react. So that's a very odd conversation that we're having, which is really kind of detethered from the actual infrastructure that we're talking about, the roads and bridges.
Right. Just to give it,
that's kind of where we are there.
Just to give a number, while you're talking about that, Patrick, Senator Roy Blunt, a Republican from Missouri, said there's $2 trillion of stranded profits overseas. This is from a T-America brief on this. And $2 trillion of stranded profits. And we're talking about these sort of broader attempts to raise additional revenue through ensuring there's the repatriation of these corporate profits that can be brought back into the federal coffers. So I just want to give people that number, $2 trillion, because, of course, it means so much.
It's certainly a very large number.
Yeah.
And to me, it's it's a fairly odd conversation that we're having if it's not hand-in-hand with comprehensive tax reform. So I think it's something that's going to be very hard for Congress to do, especially in the short time span at which we need to have a new highway bill.
Right.
The interesting thing is, and this has been brought up, you know, as the federal government becomes a less and less reliable partner, especially in infrastructure, what we're seeing around the country are states and localities stepping up and doing more of the work themselves in terms of raising revenue. So you look at places as diverse as Maryland, which is fairly liberal, to places like Wyoming, which obviously is a red state, raising their own gas taxes because they're seeing the federal government as less reliable, as incapable of actually providing the funding and financing that they're accustomed to. So we're seeing that. We're seeing really high percentages of ballot initiatives passing across the United States. You're talking about 70% roundabouts of cities every time they put up an initiative to pay for a new transportation measure, they pass in terms of increasing sales taxes or other types of fees and levies. So certainly there's this up by the bootstraps mentality we're seeing in a lot of places as they see the federal government taking a step back here in terms of its historical responsibilities. But again, that's very challenging, especially in places with smaller tax bases or places that are still trying to economically get back up on their feet. And another trend we're seeing is an interest in public-private partnerships, which are basically turning over certain aspects of the operations or maintenance or financing of different infrastructure assets, public roads, that kind of thing, to the private sector. So a lot of times people think about toll roads as being public-private partnerships. But we're also seeing places like Pennsylvania do public-private partnerships for bridge replacements. They replace several hundred just rural bridges, primarily using a public-private partnership, using kind of a complicated business model. But there's a lot of interest in trying new things. And certainly, you know, you look at places like Tennessee. Tennessee, the governor and the Secretary of Transportation said, we're not going to be moving forward on any major projects until we get certainty that the federal government's going to get its act together. And I think that's problematic because as someone who spends a lot of time on Capitol Hill, they are not getting their act together. And I'm not entirely sure that they will after another presidential election. So I think really states and localities need to focus on how they can help themselves and how they can generate their own revenues, their own financial tools to really bring them forward into the, you know, the next 10, 20, 40, 100 years. Certainly there's always going to be a strong role for the federal government, and certainly the Highway Trust Fund needs to be shored up. But considering the state of discourse in D.C., I think people need to be ambitiously thinking about ways that they can really secure their own futures.
Rocky Moretti, on private-public partnerships, what's Tripp's take on that, if any?
Well, I think it's somewhat, as Patrick said, I mean, it's looking at all the different options that are out there. I mean, public-private partnerships are going to work on specific types of projects, largely very significant projects that are likely to carry, again, you know, higher volumes of traffic. You know, more typically urban projects are the most obvious ones, or very critical bridges, and typically new or additional capacity. But, you know, and as Patrick has said, though, the trend this year, and really the last 2 years, has been states stepping to the plate. And, you know, and this year there's been a number of other ones, including Iowa and Utah, just in the last several weeks. And now Washington State and Texas and a number of other states are looking at very significant transportation packages, usually tied to some type of user fee, although sometimes a sales tax or some other type of general fee as well. So states clearly, it's not that the federal government has backed away from transportation, but has really been, it's been status quo for really the last decade. And traditionally in the past, you would see every 5 or 6 years a significant boost in federal investment in highway and transit. And really the last decade has just stayed at the same level. It's a very significant level and very critical in states in terms of funding their programs. But they're recognizing that waiting for Washington to solve the problems in each state is really not going to get the job done. And that's why I think you see state legislative bodies starting to really step to the plate.
Sam Anthony.
Well, I think that's very difficult for New York State. We're pretty different than a lot of states, primarily because of our age. But, for example, on the bridge side, we have 7,000 state-owned bridges, but we have 11,000 municipal, town, city, county-owned bridges. So the ownership issue becomes a problem. I think, you know, for a state government to say, you know, we're going to take care of all of it in New York is very difficult because our gas tax is already the highest in the country, I believe, and we, you know, the ship can't take much more, really. But we're ASCE is open to any kind of funding mechanism that the federal government comes up with, and based on my trip down to D.C. a month ago, I received a letter from Tom Reed's office. You know, he's
a congressman, yeah.
Congressman for the Southern Tier, and he sent me this letter with a list of all the congressmen that support a new highway bill, a six-year highway bill, and it's the majority. It's 66% of them, and in New York State we have 27, and more than 20 New Yorkers signed it. And you know, I don't think you know the funding, how we fund it, is the real problem. Everybody's for it. It's just how do we do it?
So is it fair to say then you're slightly more optimistic about the federal highway bill perhaps than our Washington friends?
I think I am. And I think, you know, it's the devil's always in the details. But I feel like, especially in light of the fact that I've been doing this, going to Washington the last 4 years, you know, there is more and more discussion of this topic. And like you say, it's not sexy. It's not that interesting. But people have to get from point A to point B, no matter what. And we're the rubber band has been stretched as far as it can go. I think the engineers in our community should be commended for doing as the best they can to keep that everything open. I mean, you folks have probably seen that the barge canal bridges are always being shut down and repaired. Mm-hmm. But you know, don't expect that to stop. You know, because
well, some of they're 100 years old or more.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
The assets you're talking about, right?
That's right.
Some of our listeners have some questions about how certain things are funded or paid for, and I don't know if anyone on the panel, Sam, perhaps can help address this. But Andy from Lima called in and said his understanding is that New York State has a designated road fund, especially for all the heavy-duty trucks. Why isn't the funding all used for repair rather than just a small portion used for repair?
Well, I think he's right. There is a dedicated highway and bridge fund. Unfortunately, it's not really being used for that these days. It's really being used to pay for debt. And, you know, we've kind of gotten ahead of ourselves. We know we have to fix things, so we'll borrow and we'll pay off the loan through the dedicated highway and bridge fund. So there has been an effort by our local legislators to make that secure, but it's you know they have to figure out where to get the money to pay for the debt. So
we're robbing Peter to pay Paul in a lot of ways here, aren't we?
We are.
Yeah,
and I think though the debt issue is something that's really fascinating. If you look at the size of the tax exempt municipal bond market in the United States, I mean that's you're talking about a $4 trillion market that pretty much goes towards infrastructure, and that's not only roads. It covers a lot of different topics. But really, if you look at what new debt is being offered in the United States, the vast majority of it is just refinancing. It's not borrowing to build new capacity or for maintenance. Really, people are just trying to bring down borrowing costs. And also, if you look at cities and states across the United States, increasingly, every time they get extra money, they're really having to plow it into things like pensions or debt servicing costs because, you know, they're getting squeezed in a very similar way as the federal government is in terms of changing where they're allocating their money and pushing that towards, you know, basically paying legacy costs.
We are late for a break, but I want to get another listener coming in from Twitter who writes in to say that please tell the man who helped design the Freddie Sue Bridge, and I didn't say Freddie Sue. Every time I say Freddie Sue on this program, someone calls in to say, please say the full name, Frederick Douglass Susan B. Anthony Bridge, and I absolutely respect that. But I think Freddie Sue, people use it as a term of endearment sometimes, Sam. I do. And the gentleman says, tell the gentleman who helped design the Freddie Sue that he's a genius. He has blessed this community for generations. So there.
Thank you very much.
Well, and you know what? I think his comment is probably shared by a lot of people who drive on that bridge every day. Let's get a short break in and come right back here. Sam Anthony is the man we're talking about helping design that bridge. He's a bridge engineer at consulting firm Urban Anthony and the president-elect for the American Society of Civil Engineers Rochester Section. Patrick Sable from Brookings Metropolitan's on the line with us, and Rocky Moretti from TRIP, Director of Research, Transportation Research Group there. Both of them in Washington, D.C. And Matthew Leonard, the editor of the Innovation Trail, is in studio with me on this Innovation Friday, right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, understanding the Affordable Care Act, the implementation of the ACA. We're talking Affordable Care Act with a panel sponsored by the League of Women Voters. There's a Monday night forum, but first, that panel is on our show on Connections. We'll answer your questions on the implementation of the ACA. Anything you want asked and answered, have it ready Monday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Corning Museum of Glass, presenting its contemporary art and design wing. The new space features 120 contemporary works in glass and a 500-seat hot glass demonstration space. CMOG.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The fourth Friday of every month is Innovation Friday, and that's when I seed a lot of the work to the man who's always working, Matthew Leonard, the editor of the Innovation Trail. And Matthew has been guiding us through a conversation on infrastructure, which is so important. Matthew, what's next on the agenda?
Well, one of the things, one of the ways in which infrastructure has come up, Evan, as you have covered yourself, is with regard to the state budget windfall or one-off kind of surplus, let's call it that.
The bank settlement for
right,
money?
For
something
New York
along
state.
The lines, $5 to $6 billion.
Right, yeah. And that was where a conversation, so there were several conversations, including contributions for people like the state controller, Tom DiNapoli, who really made a very strong argument for that bank settlement money to be used for things like infrastructure to kind of catch up, essentially as a kind of catch-up payment. It also came up because of the commitment that New York's Governor Cuomo made to replace the Hudson River crossing, the Tappan Zee Bridge. And as we said in our opening, there's yet to be a kind of concrete blueprint for what the funding for that will be. We do know that that the tolls may be up to three times as high as the current rate of $5 to cross the current bridge. So getting back to that kind of, what do you think, Rocky Moretti, what do you think that people are prepared to pay for as users of infrastructure? When do you sort of reach critical, a kind of some sort of threshold of resistance from people who say, yes, in principle, you know, yes, I obviously, you know, believe we need robust infrastructure and I want to be able to drive safely on my commute. And we know that you point out in your report too, factors like population growth and urban expansion and so on are going to increasingly put pressure on those assets. So, but what do you think the user is prepared to pay for in terms of things like tolls or other charges or gas tax, indeed?
Well, I think Patrick kind of alluded to that earlier when he talked about that most of the local initiatives that have been put on the ballot generally have passed. And what we find, and also at the state level, is that the public, for one thing, wants a good transportation system, that they also want it in excellent condition, but they don't want to see any orange barrels while repairs are being implemented. So, I mean, to some extent, obviously, we all want the system in good shape, but we want the work done and over with. But that said, generally, the public is supportive of transportation investment and paying for that transportation investment if they think those dollars are going to be spent in their community in a way that they're going to benefit from, and also if they think the stewardship of the system by the local and state transportation agencies, if they have confidence in them. And so it really does take the education of the public of what's the condition of the system, what are the implications for them, what are the implications for the economy, and then confidence that the money's going to be well spent. Mm-hmm. And so it's not as simple as saying do they support it or don't support it. Generally, the public is supportive of investing in transportation, and we think, you know, TRIP has put out 15 reports this year, and we were in Texas last week, and I was in Seattle earlier this week and Detroit on Monday. Largely because these are states where major transportation decisions are being made, and we're working with Chambers of Commerce and a variety of groups. And what we hear back again is the public recognizes the importance of infrastructure, but you do need to walk them through what these implications are. And also, they need to feel confident that the additional investment is going to make the repairs that are needed. Right. Again, as was discussed earlier.
So you're saying it's not a difficult sell at the electoral level if people have confidence in those agencies that are handling that.
And that also they're going to get bang for their buck, that these are going to be making the repairs that are necessary. It's going to make the system safe for safety. We haven't really discussed that much, but the reality is when states or local governments go in and do very cost-effective safety things, add in rumble strips, pave some shoulders, put guardrails where they're appropriate, make sure the lighting and striping of roadways, are put in place and are in good condition, the number of serious and fatal crashes drop significantly. So that can be part and parcel of that education of the public. But they do, like a good customer, they have to understand what's at stake and what it's going to cost them. And if you do all those steps, the public will be supportive.
I think the tricky thing here is oftentimes it's on ballot initiatives and getting people to support infrastructure generally. If you can give those kind of promises we've talked around about, good governance and bang for your buck, I think where it gets really complicated, especially with some of the bridge projects we're talking about, is increasing tolls or adding tolls on assets that didn't have them in the past. And we see that as a real struggle for places. You see that they only work where the government can show you're getting something new, not just kind of reinforcing an existing service.
Right. Sam Anthony, I just wanted to ask you before Evan's got a comment from a listener, but in terms of things like integration of bridge approaches, so let's say you're building a new asset, a new bridge, and this came up, I believe, with discussion. There was some discussion of replacing a crossing at Irondequoit Bay, where I think Charles Schumer was pushing for a permanent year-round all-weather bridge crossing on Lake Ontario there. And I think the point was made by Louise Slaughter, indeed, who said that the approaches to a new bridge crossing like that would have to extend like 4 miles back in either direction in order to kind of... So is part of the issue too sort of integrating new assets with old infrastructure, and that you could have a fantastic new bridge, but then the approach roads or it puts pressure indeed on the existing assets that maybe haven't got the funding the way the existing the new project does.
Absolutely. Our firm actually was the engineer of record for the Irondequoit Bay Outlet Bridge that's there now, and I remember back in the day when we did that, it was very controversial. I call it the most democratic bridge in the country because half the people are happy half the time. But, it's in the end, we settled on a seasonal bridge, and I think it's performing well. The cost to do something there to make it permanent would be extraordinary. To me, it wouldn't be the proper thing to do.
I just have one bone to pick with you, which is that during summer, you have to drive all the way around to get to that great little pub on the other side. Never mind. That's all right. I'm happy half the time. So,
let me get to a listener question. John writes to the program Listening Online. John writes, quote, the federal Davis-Bacon Act requires contractors on federally assisted public works projects to pay so-called prevailing wages, which are well above market rate wages. The law was passed in 1931, largely to prevent African-American workers from competing on price with the white unions that excluded them. Do your guests know if there is any prospect of repealing or reforming this outdated law so that we can get more infrastructure improvements for each dollar spent? Again, that's John in Rochester. Rocky, Patrick, Sam, anyone want to jump in?
I mean, I can jump in quickly. I mean, it's kind of been a Republican focal point for a long time around Davis-Bacon. However, I don't think there's a lot of I don't think it'll be included in any reforms coming up. And honestly, certainly our friend from ASE can speak to this more clearly. It doesn't seem to be one of the core problems holding back investment right now. To me, it seems like it's a lot of just developing new funding sources, having better long-term planning that goes along with those dedicated resources, as opposed to a very specific policy like that. And especially when you're looking at these kind of state and local projects, a lot of times they can get around these federal eligibility issues if it's more local funding. Right. But others on the call might have a better take on exactly how it plays out in your region.
Sam?
In New York State, we have a strong program for inclusion of disadvantaged business enterprise. And every single project that I've worked on includes that. So I think that's an meeting federal requirements, and I think it's been a very efficient program.
Can I just ask too for perhaps our Washington guests can talk to? I understand that the U.S. Department of Transport is also they're setting higher performance measures to govern how federal dollars are spent. In other words, kind of putting more of the onus on states to ensure and meet performance marks for the spending of federal dollars. Could you talk us through that, perhaps, Patrick or Rocky?
Well, certainly the last bill that went through just over 2 years ago increased the use of performance measures, and I know that states, the initial challenge for them, of course, is to put in place all of those reporting mechanisms. And so I think it's going to take some time. Obviously, the intent is to make sure that you're rewarding good stewardship. And I think it's just going to, and it will quite likely that the next federal program will continue and will build off of that program. And so I think we will see over the next several years what that impact is on the stewardship of the system.
Because I understand, to your earlier point about safety issues, that was one of the things that some lobby groups kind of pushed the DOT on to ensure that performance measures around safety were kind of rigorous and a part of the rewrite of the transportation law.
Well, and I think state transportation agencies are much more comfortable than they were even a decade ago with comparisons between states. You know, obviously states have very different situations in terms of population, topography, and climate, but nonetheless, a lot of data, and our organization certainly takes advantage of all those data in terms of pavements and bridge conditions and traffic safety. And I think states now have come to the conclusion that it's helpful to have some comparative data. So you can take a look and compare yourself to others and see how you're doing, and also learn from states that may be showing more success in certain areas.
Just moving on to another point, Patrick, could you talk us about, just talking about the Brookings support for Build America bonds. Could you talk us through why you think that could be a useful kind of engine in this whole discussion around infrastructure?
Yeah, so I mean, we spend a lot of time talking about these big funding mechanisms, but really the federal government plays a really strong role in helping to finance projects across the country. So helping people tap debt markets, helping states and localities borrow money. And so, you know, we've had tax-exempt municipal bonds for over 100 years. That's been really the way we've helped states and localities finance things for a long time. We've had private activity bonds. It's another kind of category. And during the recession, one of the things that the administration pushed forward was something called Build America bonds. And fundamentally, that was just a different subsidy structure, which gave states and localities a lot more flexibility. And so when we look at the ways that the federal government to be a better partner with states and localities is to give them more flexible financing tools. And so Build America bonds, we can get into the exact subsidy structure, but pretty much that gave a direct subsidy. It was about 27-32% to states and localities that drove down their borrowing costs. So it really lets states and localities, you know, get cheaper debt to do a lot of these different projects. That program fell through for a lot of reasons, having to do with the sequester and just general federal dysfunction. But we're seeing that these types of tools, there's proposals for America Fast Forward bonds, there's a proposal for qualified public infrastructure bonds. It's really an alphabet soup of fairly technical financial jargon. But really what this is about, the markets and allowing more people and more different types of investors to get involved in public infrastructure. So there's a lot of conversation that in D.C., mostly because that's not tied to do we repatriate international taxes or do we raise the gas tax. It's really about can we give places more flexibility to try things, to experiment in different ways, which I think is really, if the federal government's not going to be a big funding partner in the future or if they're scaling back, you know, their ambitions, they need to be able to give, you know, everybody on the ground a lot more ability to try new things. And so I think that's really the focus of what needs to happen as we kind of reevaluate what the U.S. Department of Transportation's role is in infrastructure.
just to change tack a little bit and just look at some future challenges and opportunities in our last sort of 8 minutes or so, Sam Anthony, from the American Society of Civil Engineers point of view, you maintain, along with some other organizations like TRIP, a kind of reporting regime where you sort of do a report card for the nation's infrastructure. I wanted to ask you about things like the role of the way in which things like increasingly unreliable weather patterns, climate change, are going to present challenges for infrastructure and infrastructure planning going forward.
They are, and I think we're adapting to it. I mean, I think New York State is very conscious, for example, on bridges about scour, and the failures we've had are related to scour. And this, the
about scour?
Scour, so the foundations.
The layman's definition of scour is?
Well, when the rushing water runs really fast, it eats away the material below the foundation.
Thank you.
And that's exactly how Schoharie Creek, the thruway over Schoharie Creek, failed. And, you know, a lot of our failures are related to fast-moving water. And I think the state understands that and has responded to it. And now the likelihood of that is very small when we design new bridges.
Right.
It's the old ones we have to worry about. But yes, the ASCE, each state is developing their own report card. And, you know, roads and bridges are part of what civil engineers do, but there's a bunch of other things. And what we're doing is, and I'm involved in this process now in New York State, what we do is provide a letter grade, like you got in school, for very many different issues that we work on, including dams and levees, drinking water, hazardous waste, wastewater, aviation, bridges, inland waterways, ports, rails, roads, transit, parks and recreation, schools, and energy transmission. So each one of those things will have a letter grade when we're done. And we should be done in the fall. And other states have found it's been very useful to illustrate to the public how either good or deficient something is. And this way, once it's broadcast, they can talk to their legislators and say, look, we need to fund this thing because it's deficient.
Right. So it's a way of driving participation in those sorts of conversations. Rocky Moretto, I wanted to ask you about this issue of how sometimes development and economic expansion can sort of very quickly outstrip existing infrastructure. And I'm thinking of things like some of the effects that we've seen through the oil and gas industries, very, very rapid expansion. I mean, North Dakota would be an example in the Bakken oil fields, where there's very, very quick deployment of, drilling teams, drilling infrastructure, and that kind of thing. And often local authorities are left kind of scrambling to deal with, you know, very, very sudden arrivals of heavy traffic and so on. I mean, does that present challenges as well? Because it's definitely economic development and growth, but it can also impose real challenges on municipalities, particularly in local government.
We're seeing this particularly in rural areas, and obviously in some states in particular, North Dakota, Wyoming, portions of Texas, but even some states that are really just now getting into the area of new energy development, whether it's fracking, whether it's wind energy, which brings in a lot of large vehicles when it's actually being put in. And we're also seeing significant growth in agriculture. And so what starts to happen is these little rural roads that barely carried any vehicles are now becoming significant economic corridors. And, of course, the roads are crumbling and falling apart. And the normal way to pay for them, which is usually user fees, don't come anywhere close to the type of infrastructure improvements that are necessary. And so, again, typically those states are also capturing a significant boost in energy funds. And so you do see the discussion that this, you know, economic growth is very much welcome, but you don't have the infrastructure in place to accommodate it. And so looking at creative ways to pay for some of the types of major improvements that are necessary. We did a report in Wyoming a few years ago on the most critically needed new infrastructure, and almost all of it was tied to the boom in energy extraction. So that certainly is a very significant issue in a number of states. A
couple of listener comments will help us wrap up the hour here. Dwayne called in from Rochester, and he says it's a matter of lives lost if a bridge collapses. Thinking back to a falling bridge during Mario Cuomo's time that took some lives, Is that Schoharie? That's Schoharie that you were talking about, Sam. Dwayne writes, in other words, we should be funding our infrastructure, period. Mark writes, why isn't this sexy? Isn't infrastructure an immediate jobs program, or am I watching too much House of Cards? Gentlemen, too much House of Cards, or is Mark right there? This is a jobs program waiting to expand.
Just quickly, the jobs numbers are a little dicey. As someone who's a professional researcher, you hear the number $1 billion buys you 25,000 jobs. I think what's better to look at, as opposed to kind of a stimulus-related program, is how it supports the local economy and kind of the long-term investment in jobs, where you get operators, engineers, people who are part of the maintenance crews, who that's not just a one-time investment. Those people have jobs for the duration. And pretty much we did a big study looking at the infrastructure's impact and jobs in the United States. And almost 11% of America's employment is tied to investments in infrastructure. So it's legitimately a very large part of, the American economy. So I think it's not just a house of cards, not just a political play. It really does matter to our economy, and not just, the guy who's cooking lunch for the person who's the secretary of the construction firm, but really the people every day who are working on these issues and every day part of the local economies, whether that's the freight and logistics guy who's working at a hub moving stuff from a train to a truck. I mean, you're looking at all these things that really have a huge impact just on jobs themselves.
And Mark, there is no such thing as too much House of Cards. Final thoughts, Matthew Leonard?
Just a quick comment, Rocky, just in terms of that point around employment, and we saw this obviously through things like the interstate highway system, but what's Tripp's kind of take on that?
We got about 20 seconds. Go ahead, Rocky.
We've been in a number of states this year, and really the message that I think is underlines all this issue is you can't build a healthy economy on the foundation of a crumbling transportation system.
Well said.
Rocky Moretti, thanks very much for joining us. Director of Research for Tripp in Washington, D.C. Patrick Sables joined us from Brookings Metropolitan. Thanks very much, Patrick, for your contributions. Great to talk to you. And also with us in the studio, Sam Anthony, bridge engineer at consulting firm Urban Anthony, president-elect for the American Society of Civil Engineers Rochester Section. Thank you very much for being with us in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
And Sam, I am going to think of you every time I drive across the Frederick Douglass Susan B. Anthony Bridge. Thanks for the work that you do. Matthew Leonard's the editor of the Innovation Trail. Another wonderful Innovation Friday. Thank you, Matthew Leonard.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Evan. InnovationTrail.org, WXXINews.org for the podcasts and for additional information on all the topics we've covered today.
Thanks to engineer John Andrews. Have a lovely weekend. Talk to you Monday.